Close the wall up with our ears. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Sorry, I'm turning knobs over here.
And can you turn my mic up just a little bit?
Yeah, I'm thinking that both of our mics are a little low.
So this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the brilliantly informed name of a riveting radio program. You like that? That's hyperbole and a half. It is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado. By the way, the SEC neither approves or disapproves. That's just who we register with and who regulates us. This voice you hear talking and the other voice, say something, other voice.
Something other voice.
Okay. Are the voices of people who are the principals of and advising members of the Personal Wealth Coach, the investment advisory firm.
You can tell us apart because the other guy over there has a white beard and I have a much darker beard.
That's getting little flecks of gray in it.
Yes.
That's interesting.
It's just hanging around you. You must be contagious.
I probably am.
Age is contagious. Anybody?
Age is contagious.
Ooh.
Ooh. We could use that. Hey, and the information we provide here, even though we are an investment advisory firm, as well as the principals here on this radio program, the information we provide is not investment advice on the program. It is instead intended to be educational. Investment advice is something we give to individuals. And this should not be considered to be investment advice.
Our views are our views and not the views of Town Square Media. How's that? We'll throw that in there too.
A, B, C, D, F, G, H, A, K, K.
I don't know why.
How about views? S views? Our views versus S views.
I think we should say opinions. Usually they say the views expressed by the. It's like, how do you express a view? Well, it's got purple mountains in the distance and.
Purple mountain majesties.
Yes. Yeah.
Across the fruited plain.
Right. That's our view.
Okay.
And it really literally is.
Which is similar to an RV. Anyway, to go on, the information that we do present in this educational presentation is obtained from sources we believe to be reliable and consistent and accurate. Things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Barron's, Bureau of Economic Analysis, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and things and sources of that ilk.
We also have some others in there.
We could go on all day with the others. But that's
Birkbeck, the University of London, Harvard Business Review. There's the Wall Street Journal,
yeah.
BBC. Basically, when we touch things like Washington Post or New York Times, we stay so far away from the opinion section that we're turning the pages with a very long stick.
Yeah, and we try to stay away from opinion, although there's a limit to how much anybody can do that.
Because we have our own.
We do.
Yeah, we have opinions. And that's an opinion, not a fact.
That's your opinion.
That's my opinion.
Let's see. What else do we got to say? Close cover before striking. It seems like there's some other caveat we should put in. Anyway, today is
unauthorized personnel only beyond this point.
Right. And we love the sign on the door here at the radio station. On the inside, it says this door must remain closed at all times,
which makes it a very ineffective door, much more like a wall.
Yes,
think
because
about that.
That means if you get in here, you can't get out because you'd have to violate the sign.
Well, if you got in, it means you violated the sign even though you didn't know it. You know, I quite often will send texts to my friends, and the message of the text is, do not read this text. Never once has it been obeyed. Not a single time has someone not read that text.
It's that you know of.
I should work for the government. Do you know what kind of fines I could bring into the Internal Revenue Service if I was writing the code? I would say, this portion of the code under penalty of law shall not be read by anyone, punishable by a fine of $18 million per minute.
I don't think that would work real well.
It would bring a lot of revenue into the government.
Anyway,
that's Venezuelan law right there.
Right. Okay. Today is March 31st, 2018. It is the last day of the first quarter, although the 29th of March was the last market day of the first quarter of 2018. And if you'd like, if it's the 31st of March where you are in the end of the first quarter and the day before April Fool's Day.
And Easter,
which are both going to occur on the same day this year.
What is Saturday called in the Christian belief structure between Good Friday and Easter?
It's actually, the only thing I've ever heard it called is Holy Saturday.
I didn't see any holes.
Well, it's spelled differently.
Mm.
And maybe it's not spelled differently. Yeah, I don't know. If it's something as holy as H-O-L-Y is
maybe
holy?
Spelled like Holly.
Anyway,
it's a 1L.
You know, and maybe somebody can provide us with an answer for what the official religious name in the Christian religion is for the Saturday that falls between Good Friday and Easter Sunday.
First, I had to turn the switch from last hour. Oh,
I know that the Thursday before is called Maundy Thursday, and there's
which
a lot
is
of
very confusing.
Going.
Yes, we've got a caller on 773-1400. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Hey, there was an article in the Wednesday Wall Street that said that Bank of America Merrill Lynch has compiled 19 indicators that have preceded past bear markets and says right now 13 of 19 have been tripped. Are you familiar with those, and what should we pay attention to? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, Jake's probably going to get on the internet.
I'll get the article up just.
But let me say something. Merrill Lynch and Bank of America have done such an amazingly poor job of forecasting what the markets are going to do historically that whatever they come up with, I'm immediately prejudiced against. Now, if you go to Moody's Analytics or any there's other analytical firms who have had some pretty good consistent results over the years of saying, here comes the bear market. And I will say that the big one would be the conference board leading economic indicators, because we simply don't get bear markets as opposed to corrections. We simply don't get bear markets historically in the United States unless we have a recession. Now, you can nitpick that like 1987 could be called a bear market, but we came out of it so fast it was just really a major correction. Whereas 2000 through 2002, that was a serious bear market. The one in 2007 was a 2008, 2009, that was a bear market. And those were accompanied by pretty significant recessions. So the issue is that the market reflects the economy if you're a long-term investor. Now, if you're short-term speculating, it can reflect almost anything. It's like a roulette wheel or something. But the fact that Merrill Lynch went out of business the last time the market turned down and had to be liquidated and sold to it ceased to be an independent firm and had to be sold to Bank of America on the last bear market suggests that their ability to forecast a bear market may not be perfect. And the fact that they don't they're just a branch of Bank of America, also suggests that they're less than perfect. And so there's a whole series of things here. Let me throw, while Jake's still looking, let me throw one other thing in here. You can cherry pick history. It's called data mining. And find a set of circumstances that preceded almost anything. And say, this is the set of circumstances that precedes a bear market. This is a set of circumstances that precedes a bull market. And come up with it and publish it and say, looky here, and scare everybody and get everybody's attention. That's a wonderful hypothesis. The problem is that is illogical, literally illogical. It is unscientific. The issue is if someone's doing this correctly, saying, okay, we found a series of things that precede a bear market or a series of things that worked in the past. Let's put them in effect and see if they work in the real world. That's science. In other words, if Bank of America, Merrill Lynch comes up with a set of things and said, this is what precedes bear markets, and they accurately forecast a bear market, bingo. And the problem is, if they come up through data mining with a series of things because they want to scare everybody into thinking a bear market's coming and get more business, but their series of things contradict what the ones that work say are happening, that's like saying, we have found a theory of anti-gravity. This is what happens for you to levitate, and we'd like you to invest in it. You find something, Jake?
Yeah, I've got a few things. Some of them are leading indicators from the standard conference boards area. One of them is an indicator that if it's used in the last probably 15 years is very accurate, but when it's used for longer periods, you got a real problem. It's something called the ERR. Let me throw that out there. Earnings Revisions Ratio. You got to have lots of acronyms when you're talking econ speech. Earnings Revision Ratio is the number of revisions that analysts have on the three-month earnings. So that sounds like it would be a pretty good number to use when looking for bear markets, except that 15 years ago, it was normal for revisions to be on the downward side. So an analyst would say, this is what we expect earnings to be for the next 3 months, and then they'd have to come back in and say, oh, I was over-optimistic. Well, they're not too often overly optimistic anymore. After Dodd-Frank, that ERR, the earnings revisions ratio, got thrown out the window by a lot of people because the revisions tend to be upward. And one of the 13 points is earnings revision ratio, because people have come in with higher expectations of earnings rather than lower. That's the opposite of an indicator for a bull market, unless you're just using the number in general to say analysts were wrong, therefore we're supposed to have a bear market. So that's one of the 13 that was tripped. 11 of them were tripped as of December of last year, of the 19. And this is one of the issues. They've only been using this number for less than a year, these 19 indicators. And they've only been shown to be accurate during a very relatively short period of time in the market. So they started in the 90s. And if you look at the 90s, and that's that example of another one is the consumer confidence, which is, to my view, quite funny, because leading indicator consumer confidence generally is a reverse indicator. When consumer confidence is going really, really well, that's a time to be worried, not a time to be happy. Consumer confidence tends to be overconfident right before a crash.
I just read the article in the Wall Street Journal, and if you go down about halfway through the article, there's what I think is a very accurate statement. It says, follow 68%, 13 of 19 indicators were tripped. Yeah.
It might seem high, but the market has done better than
that. It says, while a 68% hit rate might seem high, this threshold was typically reached an average of 2 years before stocks peaked in the past seven bear markets, according to the Bank of America report. So it's one of those things to read into. There are far, far, far more accurate and actually simple methodologies. One of the things that I noted about their list of items is some of them, you basically have to be a major broker-dealer or analyst firm in order to track these indicators. You can't, as an individual investor, you can't do it. And again, I'm going to be kind of frank and open here. I don't much care for Merrill Lynch because of the fact that they hype and they sell, and that's their business. They're not in the business of giving investment advice. They're in the business of ratcheting up their revenue. And one of the things they want to do is pull you in and say, we have this special set of indicators so we can forecast bear markets and bull markets, and you should therefore right. do business with
this
us.
This is a marketing thing.
But again, remember, they missed the last bear market so severely
that it put them out of business,
that they went bankrupt.
Yes.
And that is an indication that they may not be really good at predicting bear markets.
What we can tell you, and this is one of their indicators, is the fear number. They use the fear number as an indicator of a bear market.
Nah.
Which is the opposite, again. So consumer confidence, ERR, fear indicator, you put all those as parts of it. What we can tell you right now is that the fear indicator, as measured by the CBOE VIX, the volatility index, is at a record level right now, which is conversely a good sign for the market. Now, we've said this quite a lot over the past several months. We don't expect this year to be as wonderful as last year was in the market. But the market is run on earnings, and earnings are up. There's a lot of ways you can calculate earnings, and I have gone through quite a few of them, and when you get to the end of them, all of them are up right now as far as across the board. There are a lot of companies that have bad earnings. There's a lot of companies that are overpriced, so don't get me wrong there. But earnings are up across the board in the United States. This is a fairly easy number to track, fairly easy because we just had a huge tax cut for corporations. So earnings are up almost by definition across the board, unless someone was just losing money already hand over fist, which means they didn't pay taxes at all. Earnings are up. If they made a small profit, their small profit became larger because taxes are down. So that's one of the drivers of the stock market. It would take a massive shift to go against that. If you're thinking about profitability of a business, and the profitability just went up by a significant factor, that's not one of the 19 indicators. If your profitability across the board for the entire stock market just went up, except for companies that are already losing money, and even them, they're able to come forward with, you know, this is just a kind of tongue-in-cheek moment. A lot of companies that have reported price hits and saying, you know, the tax cut means that we have to write down a bunch of assets. There are assets that they're writing down. Writing down means deducting. They've got, oh man, we just have to get rid of that asset. It's not worth anything anymore. Was their past losses? Their past losses were in a higher tax bracket, so they can't apply the higher tax bracket against the lower tax bracket. So if they were paying in the 36% bracket, and they come forward, and now they're getting a deduction for 36%, only they're getting 21% of it. It means that they don't have as much of value in their loss, which is obtuse and obscene in my vision, that the tax code becomes an asset. When you've had a loss, you shouldn't consider it an asset, but people do.
Well, it is, in the sense that if you can't deduct your loss this year,
right,
you have to carry it forward several years.
Right. But when you carry it forward at 36%, but you only get a 21%
right.
credit for it, I still think it's obtuse and obscene that you should get a loss as an asset. It makes sense, but it's still obtuse and obscene.
I'm of the opinion the same thing should happen there that's happened when they purchase equipment. You buy it, you deduct it from your taxes.
Right.
If you take a loss in a given year, you should be able to deduct the whole thing. But the tax code was set up for corporations in such a way that if they had a big loss in a given year and that exceeded their income, and you know, this happens, then they can take that loss and carry it forward. And there's a lot of argument in favor of that. And I think there's some reasonability.
There's some reasonability. Right. What just goes to the point that taxes being arbitrarily written out for 12-month periods when businesses run on a continuum. If you're saving money for a big purchase and the money that you've saved is sitting in your bank at the end of the year. You owe taxes on that money, even though you're about to spend it on something that's deductible.
The article also, by the way, talks a little bit about, and I did a little research here real quickly on how Merrill Lynch came up with this. And they basically said, if we look at all of the circumstances that have triggered, that we look at everything that was in place just before a bear market triggered for the last four bear markets, which is, by the way, not a lot.
That's not very far back. That's my biggest complaint about these.
Then when you get 100% of these, you're going to have a bear market. Now, actually, when you get up to about 95%, the bear market that began in 2000, that began late 2007 and started cranked up really well in 2008, actually began when they got to 95%. Now, this of course denies a couple of things, but there's a much easier way of doing this. And when I say
much
it denies
easier.
A couple of things, it basically says that the past is going to is going to repeat itself into the future perfectly. Here's the point here's the argument they don't make. They simply have done a statistical data mining, and there's a lot of that goes on, and we think it's logical and rational, and this is the way we ought to do it. But statistical data mining does a perfect job of forecasting the past.
Yeah.
And
that's past casting.
The crucial issue is to understand the principle, at least this is my opinion, our opinion. Understand the principle behind the effect. In other words, there's a cause and effect, but what is the principle behind it? For example, Jake and I have talked a lot about a bull market climbs a wall of worry.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got a fear index that's saying a lot of people are worrying right now.
Yeah, and the consumer, the retail investor has not embraced this bull market. They have not gotten involved in this bull market.
Every time they have, we've had a little correction like what we're having right now. They're moving out of this.
So the point is, when everybody that can buy has bought, we are in for a bear market in the near future. And another good one, let me run one more here, is the Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah.
There's two very simple ones that you can track. One is the market sentiment. When everybody is convinced, and you don't have to read the Wall Street Journal, all you have to do is listen to people talk about investing. And I remember me talking about it at the steakhouse in Kerrville.
Yeah, where the people from Dell splitting and the farmers are sitting.
There was a rancher family sitting at the table next to us. Says, "I'm gonna get me some of that Dell stock. They say it's gonna split again, and every time it splits, it goes up. I figure it's about like a cow having a calf. It's worth twice as much after they split it." And I realize that this is the classic case of people that don't know the difference between common stock and livestock investing in the stock market.
And I tend to remember that conversation taking place in Fredericksburg. Well, you remember it in Kerrville. It was a long time ago.
No, it was in Fredericksburg. You're correct. It was in Fredericksburg. We were at a bed and breakfast.
Right.
You're completely correct. In the Wile E. Coyote factor, Jake was just talking about earnings.
Mm-hmm.
When corporate earnings start slumping seriously and the market just keeps going up, that's called the Wile E. Coyote factor, where he's just run off the top of
the
mesa and he hasn't looked down yet. He says, "It's no problem, no problem. I'm just running along and I'm perfectly happy." That's you want a time that you want to be concerned. It's right then.
Yeah. If you should also check your pockets. If in one of your pockets you have a sign that reads "Yipe," so the honest answer is that there are a lot of ways of measuring this, and causation and correlation are factors. You have to look what's a cause and what's just correlated. You need a lot of history for that. So there's an error there. Let's come back to the real question underlying the question, though.
The question underlying the question.
Do we think that there's going to be a bear market in the near future?
Yes.
And the answer is yes.
But that all depends on your definition
right,
of near future.
After we've just blown a bunch of holes into this indicator set up from BOA Merrill Lynch, we don't, I at least don't see it in the next 6 months. But it's possible. And let's be clear there. We haven't tripped all of the warnings in their 19 indicators. We haven't tripped all of the warnings in lots of other people's indicators either. The reality is that something that doesn't fit into any of these indicators is the tax code and a trade war. So keeping that in mind, it takes a long time for the earnings to respond to tariffs. It takes a long time for costs to be put into the math to affect earnings. Anytime you have an expense, and that's what tariffs are, it's a tax. Just, and I was just saying this to the engineer that was in here. A tariff is a tax, and it's an unknown tax to most people. When you have a simple tariff, even if it's at the same percentage and it's across the board on everyone. So let's just use this one. 25% on steel for everybody. If you're importing it to the United States or exporting it to the United States, when we import it, we slap 25% on it. That's actually better for trade than extreme exemptions of that simple tariff. Because even if you don't have the tariff, you have to do the research. You have to hire people to do the research to make sure that you don't have the tariff, and then to defend yourself against the tariff if it's not due, which is an expense. So tariff, if you look at it as any other tax, if there's a complex new tax that's just been developed that affects business, it's going to cause the price of business to go up. That's a pretty common sense statement, but it's hard for people to grasp because generally tariffs are not seen in the same light as a tax. It is a tax. It is the way that the United States funded its government for the beginning centuries of the United States. It is a tax. It can be set by Congress. It can also now be set by the president. Now, the president's got to do it for strategic purposes. We've talked about that for weeks, that yes, there are strategic implications for not having enough aluminum, not having enough steel. Strategically, we're more at risk on the aluminum side than we are on the steel side, which is, you know, kind of one of those questions of why the numbers are the way they are. But that comes back to things that we were talking about in the tax code. Why are the percentages in the tax code set the way they are? And it's pretty arbitrary. It's the way they were written because that's just the number that got written down. When we look at these tariffs, when we say why 25%, why 10%, there is no meaningful reason. It's just we're trying to show support for jobs in the United States in the steel and aluminum workers. We've talked about this as well for many weeks. Traditionally, historically, tariffs don't help those workers at all. In fact, they hurt the workers, but they hurt the rest of the country as well. We talk about that, and people, you know, I get this quite a lot during the week of, what do you mean it hurts those workers? This is something you wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
What's the stock market? How's the stock market treating steel and aluminum companies at the moment?
Well, the iconic leader, even though it's no longer the largest steel producer in the United States, is United States Steel.
U.S. Steel. It used to be the steel producer of the world. Its symbol is X.
And one letter United symbol. States Steel, since the first tweet, which was on March 1st, by President Trump saying he was going to impose 25% tariff on imported steel across the board. When he made that tweet, the pundits immediately came out. The ones who generally the columnists who don't know what they're talking about said, "Oh, buy U.S. steel, it's going to go up," or "Buy U.S. steelmakers, they're going to go up because the competition is going to be cut out." In fact, in the month of March, United States Steel Corporation price dropped 20%. Nucor, who is the largest steel producer in the United States, they have the most volume, the most everything. Is down about 9%. And matter of fact, the steel producing industry in the United States, and there's even an ETF that tracks them, is down 9% for the month. Now, yeah, the stock market dropped, but the stock market started dropping on February 26th, and they've dropped, it certainly hasn't dropped 20%. That put the stock market in a bear market position. And so I started digging around to figure out why. Turns out that the majority – we've basically used up our high production iron ore deposits in the United States. Yeah, there's still iron ore deposits in the United States, but they're expensive to mine and they're not they don't have a lot of iron in them, and the main iron comes from elsewhere. More so, this is interesting. The number one source raw material for new steel made in the United States is scrap steel.
Right. And that's what the Chinese are threatening a tariff on.
Well, that we if we put a 25% tariff on imported steel, what we've done is taking the main raw material that U.S. steelmakers use to make steel and put a 25% tariff on it. And then the second issue.
Well, this is going to result in a lot of the junkyards in the area getting scrapped, which is nice because they've been sitting there. It's been too expensive to recycle all of the car parts and then things into aluminum and steel. Well, we're going to start doing that pretty soon.
Scrap steel went up, but the point is high-quality scrap steel mainly comes from outside the United States because we don't scrap ships in the United States. The biggest source of high-quality scrap steel is scrapping of ships, and we just don't do it in the United States.
It hasn't been profitable for a long time.
And it's normally done overseas. Japan and China does a lot of it, which means China is – you're going to think this is crazy. We get one of the largest, if not the largest, sources of raw material for U.S. steel mills comes out of China's scrapping of ships all around. And what it is China doesn't much care for how much stuff they put into the air in the process.
When people have asked this, I'm going to throw this in there. People have asked, what is a better alternative to a tariff here? A very, very good alternative would be. Now, this is a reverse thing because it's a government expenditure rather than a moneymaker for the government. But when is the moneymaking for a government ever good for business? If they subsidized the recycling of steel, if they said we're going to help give grants or whatever to set up big steel recycling plants at these junkyards, that would be a big deal. That would cause the steel industry to get a boost, a big boost, in that their raw steel would be there, the profitability would go up. And the real reason why we're lagging in steel production is not raw steel or iron ore or any of that. The real reason why we're lagging is that we have very old technology in our entire refining process for steel. We're not using the mini mills or the micro mini mills. If we were using micro mini mills, we would be able to recycle and create steel at a price that is much lower than we're producing now, much closer to and lower even than what the Chinese are producing.
And one of the reasons, by the way, we're not using micro mini mills or building new steel mills across the United States, it's your fault. Whoever's listening, I don't care who you are, it's your fault.
It's all of our faults.
No, the reason is, I'm going to say, let's just say we live in Salado. Let's just say a company came along and said, we want to build a steel mill in Salado. Do you suppose that the citizens of Salado would fully support the construction of a major steel mill in Salado? And the answer is, absolutely not. And even in Detroit, you say, okay, well, Detroit's got a lot of unemployed people, and if they build a steel mill there, it'd be really cool. The problem, you're not even going to get it built in Detroit. And the reason is that there are so many empty, abandoned steel mills in Pittsburgh and Detroit that they have a really bad, let's say, odor about them.
Right.
And the people in the town simply wouldn't support. It's the NIMBY factor of not in my backyard.
Right. It is very much like when we talk about – anytime we're talking about metal refining, it's not like we have a new way of for instance, with gold. You know, we say the technology's improved and now we can get a lot more gold out of even the tailings than we used to. Well, what is the new technology? What is this grand new high-tech stuff? Power washers, high pressure water. That's it. It's not like it's a computer. They have computerized them, but it's not like it's a really, really high tech thing. But they're able to spray rocks harder and get more gold off the rocks that have been stuck to it, that got smashed into it and got pushed up into cracks and so on. It's not like it's a real new great technology. It's just a better method to catch more of the gold as it comes down. With steel, when U.S. Steel was the producer of the world and sole producer of the world at several points, Carnegie basically just steamrolled everybody, only it was a steel roll. It was the only steel producer of any size anywhere. The idea then was to combine as much of that steel production as you possibly can into one location or two locations, to make a centralized location, bring all the steel to it, melt it all down there. So all of the television footage of these things, and by the way, when we're looking at the Wall Street Journal talking about steel tariffs and so on, a lot of the pictures that they took that are being used are from the 1990s and 1980s. These massive, huge cauldrons full of molten metal. Those are not the most effective, efficient, or almost anything else anymore. At one time, that was the pinnacle of steel technology. It costs a lot of money to scrap the plant, much less create a new one. So we've talked about this with Alcoa and Century and U.S. Steel. You basically go down the thing. They've got a lot of very old machines that are still quite capable of doing what they were built to do. It's kind of like going into a woodworking shop and you got a 1950s era whatever machine, whether it's a bandsaw or a joiner or whatever. It is not the best way of doing it anymore, but they spent a lot of money on that machine. What are you going to do with it? You don't just get rid of it, except that if you don't, you're not competitive.
There's two other factors that come in on the steel tariffs that I think are very important. One is that a very significant portion of the steel producers in the United States business is exporting steel. We, in fact, do make better steel than the Chinese do. On average,
almost across the board. Yeah.
We make some really high quality steel, and so we export that really high quality steel. Mainly, a lot of it goes to Canada, by the way. By imposing an import tariff of 25%, thereby causing the price of U.S. steel manufacture, causing U.S. steel prices to go up, we eliminated our competitiveness in international markets.
Right.
Yeah, we can still sell on the international market, but here's let me show you a little bit about economics here that I think is absolutely fascinating.
We can use a sports analogy in just a minute.
Let me use this. What happens is, if the United States runs a tariff on steel, let's say we stop importing steel, and of course now that we've got all the major importers to the United States excluded from the tariff, so it's not going to work that way. But let's show why the simplicity of a simple steel tariff doesn't work. We raise the price of steel in the United States 25% by placing this import duty on it. Well, does that mean that the Chinese steel ceases to be made? No, because the Chinese don't want to lay people off. They keep making steel. And the steel now goes into the rest of the world. So throughout the rest of the world, they just lost. They still have the same production, but they just lost somebody who's buying, which means the price of steel goes down through the rest of the world. So any export that we do at that point will be into a world where the price of steel is probably 30% cheaper than we get for it in the United States. And then let's throw one other thing in. You know, we mentioned a minute ago, if we put a subsidy or something on recycling old cars, okay? The problem is the process of recycling the old car, because there's so much stuff in it that's not steel, puts phenomenal quantities of pollution somewhere.
Yeah.
And so what we've chosen to do in the United States is be able to breathe our air.
We've exported our pollution.
So we basically exported the scrapping of high-quality steel because it does nasty things to the air that you breathe and puts carcinogens in it. And
which is part of the reason why it's cheaper to do it elsewhere, is because they don't have the same regulations that we do.
So China, you can't hardly breathe, and their lung cancer without smoking rate is through the stratosphere. One of the reasons is, we ship cubed cars that have been smashed to China, where they heat them up and boil out all of the nasty
plastics,
polluting
and
stuff,
rubber, and
let it go
wire,
into the air,
copper.
And they wind up at high temperatures with nothing left but the steel. And then they export the high quality steel raw material, which is still junk. But it's something you can make steel out of.
Some of that stuff is originally U.S. steel.
Mm-hmm. But the point is, they export it back to the United States at a higher price, by the way,
because it had to get shipped both ways.
So that's why tariffs don't work.
Yeah, this is the sports analogy to show our incredible expertise in the realm of sports. Let's use the game of basketball. The game of basketball, a tariff in the game of basketball would be one college or one professional sports team saying for all home games, all incoming visiting teams have to tie their shoelaces together. So their left foot and their right foot are tied together. And during all practices, our team will only play against people who have their shoes tied together. Well, it does an amazing thing for home games. Home games, you get this distinct advantage. You get a very distinct advantage. But what you find is that because practices are all done it that way, the overall quality of your team goes down. And when anytime you go over to another team to play, you're a visiting team member, you're going to lose. You may win every time at home. The problem is that your games get less entertaining to watch. People will look at them and say, this is not really a good team. They have to handicap the other team so hard that it's not really a game anymore. And they're getting worse because of it. So that's kind of the simplified, anytime a basketball team expects to get to the Super Bowl, they're going to need to practice against teams that are better than them, not teams that are worse than them. And that tells you the extent of our sports knowledge.
And the extent of our commercial knowledge is we need to run some commercials.
Yes, we do. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join our conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We did it right that time.
We did. We can say our names occasionally.
Well, as long as we say it in the right order and we have the correct procedure and policy.
Yeah, if we don't know which order we're saying our names, we don't know who we are anymore.
Speaking of things that don't work, the tax cut is certainly an interesting thing.
I've been enjoying it so far, but
I'm hypothetically enjoying it. It's
personally
too soon for it to see what happens.
Personally enjoying it, but long term, a little nervous about the implications.
There's several issues that popped up with the tax cut. Right at the beginning, said, "Hey, this is what's going to happen. This is the forecast." And this, by the way, this bill, rather than taking like the 1986, which had many unexpected effects, taking 2 years of thinking and concentrating and figuring out what was going on, it was slammed through in just a few weeks by one party. And that's a very poor way to pass major economic moves, other than there's a worse way, which is just for the president to tweet it and get it done. I don't care what he tweets. I don't care who president is. The point is, running it through a bunch of economists who've seen this happen before may confuse the issue. You may call that the swamp, but this is the point. These guys can think about the secondary, tertiary, quaternary, and quinternary effects of this thing,
right,
that are going to be the big ones.
This is the key quote to remember here. Mark Twain said it. History may not repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Right.
And economists look for rhymes in history, the economy. When we do this in the past, all the other times we've done it, what has been the result? And then that's not the swamp. That's putting it through an expert analysis. Most economists are not fond of working in Washington, so they're by definition not part of the swamp.
So the tax cut was supposed to do several things. One, by cutting taxes on income and reducing withholding on income, it put a lot more money in consumers' pockets who would then spend it. Number two, it was supposed to cut corporate tax rates and which caused them to spend more money and make them more profitable, and B was supposed to cause them, because they were going to be taxed on their overseas. Two things happened because of the tax on their overseas holdings. Number one, we get a flood of money into the Treasury, which offsets the tax cuts we did elsewhere. Two, it caused them to bring the money home. And then there was a piece in there about deducts things immediately, which is probably a pretty good idea, at least in the short term. And that was supposed to cause corporations to invest a lot of money in new equipment, a new plant, new buildings, and so on. So those are the big things that the tax cut was supposed to do. Well, this is what we've seen so far. The surge of money that was supposed to come in, or anticipated to come in, since the bill was signed last year, should have popped up by the end of the first quarter. There was the what, in fact, we saw at the end of the first quarter so far, we haven't got the final numbers in, is the revenue to the federal government is astonishingly lower than it was expected to be.
Yeah, because the corporate money hasn't been flowing back as fast. But
they haven't paid as much taxes on the overseas money as everybody thought because there's a loophole in the bill.
It's not really a loophole. They said this is the idea. They wanted to get paid taxes. They said, you've got a bunch of money overseas. If it's liquid and available to pay taxes on it, you pay it at this higher rate.
15.5%.
If it's not, if it's in an illiquid position, you pay it at a lower
8%.
Right. So what happened is that the law came out, but doesn't go into effect immediately. It goes into effect the next quarter. So all these companies that had money overseas suddenly took all their cash and stuck it in illiquid positions, which meant that they paid half of the tax that the government expected them to pay. But it's kind of like telling your customers, hey, we're about to do a
50% off sale.
A 50% off sale. You should still buy right now at the full price. Customers, if they're at all smart, they're going to say, no thanks. So, we'll wait a moment and do it at the 50% off sale.
The tax law, in effect, then gave an incentive to put the money in. Basically said, we will allow you to save half the taxes that would otherwise be due. If you put the money into a position where you can't bring it home.
Now, the illiquid position is not like putting it away into owning real estate or something. It's something with a maturity date above 18 months. So if you're thinking CDs, if you're thinking about treasuries of another country, EU bonds, we can see this happening in multiple ways. One, revenue did not jump up drastically for the government. It went the other direction. Two, we're not seeing the dollar rise in value. If you have trillions of dollars worth of corporate money overseas sitting in euros and reals and all these other currencies, if you're taking that money home because you're paying taxes on it anyway, you would expect to see a lot of money flowing into the dollar, which would cause the price of the dollar to go up against all these other baskets of currencies. We've seen the opposite. We've seen money going overseas, not coming back here.
There's actually money flowing out of the United States, which is kind of interesting. Okay. So
I would like to be part of that, whatever course is that the money flows through. We talk about fund flows, and I would like to be out there with a bucket occasionally I'll help bail, you know.
Dipping into the fund flows.
We seem to be leaking money. Bail. No, don't bail. Put it in my pocket.
I think dipping into the cash flows as they flow overseas and back again is a federal felony.
Unless you're the government, then it's called a tariff.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so the two things up front didn't happen. And the other thing is, yes, there is more money. As of February, which is the first month that the lower withholding rates were in effect, the consumer take-home pay rose 0.4% in the United States, which indicates, okay, the tax cut went into effect.
Right.
Here's the problem. Consumers reduced their spending in February, even though they had more money in their pockets.
So they have even more money in their pockets, which, by the way, kudos, America. Good job. That's actually a good, smart move. It's not smart for the government, but it's smart for you because the taxes are already set to rise back up to higher than what they were based on the existing law. So you better hang on to that stuff and save for a little while.
So what happened is interest rates started up because one of the reasons was because the United States started borrowing money and people looked at they stopped refinancing mortgages and started trying to pay things off, which, by the way, is a long-term process where they won't inject new money into the economy. And then there's yet another effect that went in here that was kind of a little bit surprising, and I just lost it. let's see. Okay, there was the idea was that you put more money in consumer pockets, money would flow home from overseas. Didn't happen. More money. Oh yeah, yeah. Here's the interesting thing. The next move the Trump administration made after the tax cut was to threaten tariffs on imported goods, which would tend to raise prices and reduce
Yeah.
Reduce the with his intent was to reduce the deficit, he said again. Now, here's the interesting point. When we import money, when the United States government borrows money, we just hit a recent, not long-term, but a recent record for the percentage of the U.S. debt. We went, and we talked about this earlier. The United States announced about a month ago that we need to borrow $1 trillion. And over the next couple of months, and they have been borrowing money at $1 trillion over a 2 month, 1 or 2 month period. The United States needed to borrow a full $1 trillion in new borrowing, which indicates we have a big deficit, by the way. And there's a lot of debt rolling over. The percentage of foreign money flowing in from outside the United States jumped to the highest it's been, I think, since 2014.
That's right around $6.4 trillion debt right
now. So that money that we borrow, that the United States government is borrowing. So the whole issue is we're going to put tariffs on there because first we lowered the tax rate and we're going to borrow more money. When we borrow money from overseas, that is an import. It increases our balance of trade deficit. It is the thing that he said he wanted to stop, to reduce our balance of trade deficit. But the point is, when the United States government borrows money from overseas, which is where we're getting more and more of our money that we borrow at the governmental level, it increases the trade imbalance. It lowers GDP. It increases the trade deficit, the very thing. And then you want to know something that's really crazy. Imposing the tariffs then effectively, and Jake pointed this out, a tariff is a tax. So we got a tax cut on businesses. Then you place a tariff on the main thing that manufacturers use in the United States, steel and aluminum, which is putting – this is goofy. Listen to this very carefully. We just cut taxes on manufacturers so that they could manufacture more, and then the United States government turned around and raised – a big tax
on manufacturing, basically.
So they cut from 35% to 21% on the taxes and then raised the deficit and raised the tax on imports of the stuff they need.
And we're out of time. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter, all that good stuff. Until next week or next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Talk KTEM, AM 1400, Temple, Texas, and streaming online at ktemnews.com.